And he said, you've got to get off all of these medications and you've got to figure out how to control this by the foods you eat. It was a much bigger motivation than I had ever had to figure out the health part and to really dive into our foods and what I was cooking with and what we were eating. We quickly started raising more of our own food. We have a relatively very short growing season, which means I've got to preserve a lot if I want to be able to eat those crops year round. That was really where I started diving in deeper. I already knew how to pressure can and to water bath can. And those were really, besides the deep freezer, those were the three methods that I relied on really heavily. And then started branching out and figuring what are other ways to preserve food. That was really my catalyst for putting up as much food as we do.
My name is Lisa, mother of seven and creator of the blog and YouTube channel Farmhouse on Boone. Join me as I share with you my love for creating a handmade home from scratch, cooking, and a little mom and entrepreneur life along the way.
Welcome back to the Simple Farmhouse Life podcast. Today, we're going to have on Melissa Norris. Now, you might know her from her YouTube channel, her blog, Instagram. She also has the Homesteading Magazine. She has a podcast. So many places. If you're in the homesteading, gardening type of space, you've probably heard of Melissa Norris, Melissa K. Norris. Today, we're going to chat about food preservation. We're getting into that time of year where you probably have a lot of things coming from your garden, or maybe you have access from other farmers in your local area. The abundance of produce is coming in. And so it is time to think about how we can put up some of that stuff for winter. Whether you are new or you've been doing this a while, I think that you're going to learn a lot from Melissa. So let's dive in. Hey, Melissa, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you coming back. I think you've been on this podcast. I've at least been on yours, and I'm pretty sure you've been on mine as well. But today we're going to talk about gardening season is in full swing. And so I think people are thinking about preserving and what that would look like if they're brand new, or maybe they want to try something new. And you have a lot of resources on that. So first, let's start with introductions. For those who don't know you, I think probably there's a lot of overlap with our podcasts. But for those who don't know you, tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me back on. I have been on, but I think it's been a while.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure to chat with you. So I do a ton of home food preservation. For those who I haven't had the pleasure of meeting before, welcome. Always fun to meet other people who are interested in this. But really, my story begins, for those who haven't heard it, is I had a health scare. It's now been, oh my goodness, actually almost 13 years now. I have to remember how old is my daughter and count backwards because she was an infant.
Yeah.
And at that time, I had my upper stomach and esophagus biopsied for cancer, and it came back benign. So I did not have cancer, but I had a lot of erosion and I had cellular change. So it was like the precursor to what would be considered like precancerous, because once those cells start to change, okay, then generally that's the progression. So thankfully at that time, I had a specialist and who did the testing. I did, you know, the biopsy, everything you go under and they go in with an endoscope and do that.
Yeah.
And he was really great because I personally haven't experienced this very much in modern Western medicine. And he said, you have to get off all of these prescription medications that you've been on. I was taking prescription medications up to 6 times a day, to one, proton pump inhibitors to stop the acid production because I had open ulcers and GERD, pretty extreme. And then I was taking, it's basically like a chemical Band-Aid that coats the stomach, but you have to take it when your stomach's empty. Like, so you had to time all my meals around all these different prescriptions, okay, and they weren't working because that's why we went in for the endoscope. And he said, you've got to get off all of these medications because they aren't doing anything. And the doses you've been on for the time period you've been on them is, I don't know why your doctor's allowed you to stay on them. And you've got to figure out how to control this by the foods you eat. And I remember thinking at the time, well, that would be great if I could control it by the foods that I ate, because don't you think I would have tried that? I would have never been on these prescriptions and been, you know, at the state of where my health was at that point. But it also was a really big wake-up call, because you have these biopsy reports sitting in front of you. You've literally got these camera scopes of the inside of your body, and you can see the damage that's being done. And you have the specialist that's telling you, if you don't figure this out, the next time you come back into my office and we run this test again, you likely are going to have cancer. So it was a much bigger motivation than I had ever had in my, you know, up until that point in my life to figure out the health part and to really dive into our foods and what I was cooking with and what we were eating. And I thought that I had a general idea of nutrition mm-hmm. and what was in foods and all of that. And I had no clue. Once I started really getting into it and understanding like how our foods are grown and how they work in the body, just all those things. And so we, at that point in time, we quickly started raising more of our own food. I'd always had a garden, had always canned certain things of food, et cetera, but never to a level where it was the majority of our food supply. And so we went in like a year's time from doing the only thing I was really growing and preserving a full year's worth that we didn't ever buy from the store was green beans and our own grass-fed beef. And so we went to doing chickens, meat birds, eggs, pork, and over 60% of our vegetables and about 75% of our fruit grown and preserved here where we live, which is in northern Western Washington state. So we have a relatively very short growing season, which means I've got to preserve a lot if I want to be able to eat those crops year round. But it was a huge motivation. And so that was really where I started diving in deeper. I already knew how to pressure can and to water bath can. And those were really, besides the deep freezer, those were the three methods that I relied on really heavily and then started branching out and figuring what are other ways to preserve food, because not all foods can be canned safely or should be, or is the best method for that. And so that was really my catalyst for putting up as much food as we do and delving into what works, what doesn't work, what is safe, what's not safe. And so that really, yeah, that was really the base of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see why you'd want to make a dramatic change. What were some of the, just going back to the health thing before we get more into like actually preserving, what were some of the most important things that you had to change right there? I know that you went from not buying local or from not preserving it from your own farm. Were there other things that you were like, all right, this is what's going to be the biggest difference from, you said there was a lot of things you didn't know. What were some of the other things that you kind of cut out and changed?
That's a great question. One of the biggest things back then is we have a lot more awareness now, which is great. But back then, I didn't really know anything about genetically modified crops. I didn't know what crops were really grown that way, what those were, what they meant. I didn't really know anything about gut health, to be honest. So, you know, I just really was eating and buying ingredients like, you know, canola oil. I didn't understand the difference between, you know, hydrogenated fats and how a lot of those things were processed. And so I threw out Crisco. I threw out any canola oil that we had, which we did. I used those and switched to grass-fed butter, real butter, and coconut oil. And then lard, because we started raising our own pigs. So I had my fats. So really, I would say that was kind of one of the first major things was the traditional fats. And then just starting to ingredient label read. And kind of my first criteria was if I didn't know how to pronounce it, or I didn't honestly know what it was. And this is going to be, some people were probably way more educated than I was at that point on what those were. But if I didn't know how to pronounce it, and I honestly didn't know what it was, then I either needed to go and look that up and research it and decide if I thought that that was okay or not, or simply not buy that item, which really necessitated us growing and raising so much of it, because I was shocked at how many things had food dye in them and high fructose corn syrup. I could not believe the amount of items that had high fructose corn syrup in it just because I had simply never looked at it before. But it was things like, tomato sauce. I had no idea like that there would be high fructose corn syrup and mass amounts of sugar in a lot of those, you know, packaged or even canned, jarred foods, et cetera, from the store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your fats that you mentioned, and then also the canned foods with the high fructose corn syrup, right there you have GMOs, because there aren't that many GMOs available. But the thing is they make their way into just about everything, because canola is one, corn. So high fructose corn syrup, soy. Yeah. I forget where we are. Yeah. I know the big ones that we're supposed to avoid: corn, canola.
Yeah, and then
soy.
Those are the biggest. So, some sugar beets. So if it's cane sugar.
Oh yes, sugar beets. Yes, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So knowing if it says sugar,
it's not an organic sugar.
Yeah. Then sleuthing down and finding out, does it say cane sugar or is it just sugar? Usually if it's made from cane sugar, it will be labeled that way. Not always.
Yes.
But yeah. Or as you said, if it's certified organic, then they don't test as often for GMOs, but they do test. And if it does have a GMO in it, then they can't label it as certified organic, is my understanding on the labels that you have on your food sources. So
yeah. And we really do forget just how much is available information wise. Now I'm writing my book and I was spending all of this time on the intro, thinking back to my journey to all of this, and that it starts about 13 to 15 years ago. And I even mentioned margarine because at the time, like, it's so well known now, like, you have to have been off the internet for the last 15 years if you still think butter's bad and margarine's better. But at that time, that was not well known. You had to dig into books from the library to figure that out. And like, margarine alternatives to butter were considered more healthy at that time.
Yeah,
but I was thinking back through it and I was like, man, there was so much I didn't know back then.
Amen. Same. Yeah. Which hopefully for anybody who's listening, that makes you feel a little bit better, because you don't know what you don't know. And so then it's once you do know, is making the decision, okay, what am I comfortable with consuming once you have that knowledge? So I say that because I know I kind of beat myself up for a while about, like, how did I not know all of this? And so giving myself grace, but also, you know, moving forward once you have that information.
Yes. Yes. I want to take a break from this episode to tell you about my 5-day blogging challenge. So 7 years ago, I started a blog, and 2 years into that journey, my husband was able to quit his job and we've been living on our homestead, raising our kids side by side. It was really a dream. And sometimes I forget, because it's been 5 years that we've been doing this side by side, just how crazy it is that we are able to do this because of a blog I started 7 years ago. I have a 5-day challenge where I like to help you figure out your strategy. It's a free challenge. We go through narrowing down your niche, crafting your brand, and coming up with a content plan for a successful blogging business. If this sounds intriguing to you, you can get that at bit.ly/5-day-blog-challenge. That's all lowercase and the 5 is the number 5. So bit.ly/5-day-blog-challenge. Again, it'll also be linked down in the show notes or the description box if you are watching over on YouTube. Okay, so yeah, once you figured that out, you mostly move to ingredients in their basic whole form, sourcing them from your own as much as possible. Therefore, you need to figure out what you're going to do throughout the winter, which leads to preserving. So the first question I want to ask you is, what's the easiest form of food preservation for those who are brand new? Let's just start here. Tell me all the different options, and then we'll get into which ones would be best if you're brand new.
Yeah. Okay. And this is a great question, because when you think about all of the options, so often we just think, when you hear the word home food preservations, we kind of immediately think canning, or at least in my my group, my realm of folks. So of course there is canning. Mm-hmm. So there's both water bath canning and pressure canning. So water bath canning for your acidic foods, pressure canning for non-acidic foods. And then you've got your freezer, which is probably the most universal form of home food preservation that almost every house is using, is a freezer, even if it's just a freezer that's part of your refrigerator or a separate deep freezer, but freezing food. And then you've got dehydrating. Mm-hmm. Then you've got fermenting. You have got freeze drying, if you have a freeze dryer, which is a newer way of being able at home to freeze dry food. Commercially, they've been freeze drying food for a very long time, but home models are a little bit more recent. Right, so freeze drying is in there. And then we have salt curing, which is typically thought of with meat, but can also be done with a lot of your leafy green herbs. And then you have got root cellaring techniques, which is kind of a little bit of a form of dehydration, but you're not actually pulling out all of the moisture. So it is technically separate. And a lot of times people think, when they hear root cellar, they think they have to have a basement or an actual root cellar. And that's actually not true. You can successfully use those techniques for quite a few different vegetables. And then you have infusion. So that usually involves vinegar and or alcohol. And I think off the top of my head, without actually looking at the list, I think we covered them all.
Yeah. And then I guess would oil, did you mention, does that go with infusion? I think you said, did you say oil?
I would, yeah. Oil would be characterized with infusion, but honestly, using oil to preserve vegetables, you have to be really careful with that because understanding botulism and how that works with vegetables, because vegetables are non-acidic. And so a lot of times I love herb and garlic infused oils. Like I think they're delicious. I love homemade sourdough bread and dip it in a garlic infused herb oil is just wonderful. But for long-term food storage, especially garlic, you have to be really careful because garlic is a root crop and it's not acidic. And so root crops in home food preservation, it's really important to understand that you have a higher chance of having botulism spores on food. It's everywhere, but especially with root crops on the peels.
Okay.
So when you're putting something into oil, it's a non-aerobic environment, so without oxygen. And botulism spores, if it is not an acidic environment of 4.6 or lower, because the lower you are on the pH scale, the more acidic it is, and botulism spores can't grow in 4.6 pH or lower acidic environments, which is why we can safely water bath can a majority of our fruits or high acid foods.
Okay.
But oil, of course, is not acidic and neither is garlic, and most herbs are not acidic either. And so if you put those herbs like garlic into oil, you're putting them in a non-acidic environment and it's anaerobic without oxygen. And so those botulism spores can grow, and garlic infused oil has tested positive for botulism. So there's a way to safely do it, which requires you to acidify it, or you need to freeze it. And a lot of people think I can do garlic infused oil and then just put it in the fridge and it will be okay. But the cold doesn't actually retard in fridge temperatures, I should say, doesn't retard botulism growth for very long.
Okay.
So in the fridge, you've got 3 days if you didn't acidify it. So that's why freezer or acidifying it. So yes, you can use oil, but I say it with caution.
Okay, but that's with a big caution.
Yeah.
So what are, I mean, we don't have to go too deep into the oil, but just since we're on the topic, what are some of the more safe vegetables to do in oil? Or is that typically something people should steer clear of till they're much more experienced?
Yeah, quite honestly, I don't use oil with vegetables for my long-term home food preservation just because of safety issues. And I know, you know, here's the thing, like, because I know people will have this question, you know, you see, especially like sun-dried tomatoes packed in olive oil, for example, or tomatoes.
Yes, I'm thinking of peppers.
Yeah.
Roasted peppers.
And roasted peppers and olive
oil. I've done that, but I never had it very long because we always end up consuming them, or like if you buy them, they're canned, right? Like they're in the oil, but then they're also canned.
Right. And so that's understanding with where you see it already done in the store like that and canned. So commercial pressure canners.
Yes.
Commercial pressure canners can reach much higher temperatures than home pressure canners. So that's why you will see a lot of things on store shelves that you're told not to pressure can at home. And it's simply for that reason. They can reach high enough temperatures to ensure the safety, but home models can't reach those high temperatures. So I don't for long-term do tomatoes in oil or peppers in oil, especially for, like I said, that long-term storage. If it's something that you want to have, you know, relatively soon, or you're going to keep in the fridge for a while, that's, you know, doing it that way.
Right.
Instead, I will do the sun-dried tomatoes and then put them in the oil long enough if you want to have them that way with the herbs at the time of wanting to eat it or a few days beforehand, that type of thing. But I don't do that for months on end.
Right.
And you've also got where tomatoes are borderline acidic. Some tomatoes are acidic, but a lot aren't. And there's also a myth that says, well, if it's an heirloom tomato, then it's automatically acidic enough. I don't have to worry about it. And that's actually false. So with the tomatoes, because they're borderline, and peppers aren't acidic at all, I just don't do long-term food preservation with those in oil, because there's lots of other ways that you're not going to have to question it and wonder if it's safe. And then you can still make those items later down the road from those, but I don't use it as a long-term form. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. You want confidence. You don't want to take all the time to grow something, take the time to preserve it, and then when it comes to actually eating it, think, should we actually do this? And that's where discussions like this give people a lot of power, because they have the confidence to know, like, okay, this is going to be something that I'm not going to give my family botulism. So with all of those different kinds,
considered. There are a few factors to try to decide which one would be best for you. One's upfront investment. So like we talked about with the freeze dryer, that's great. It's really easy. It works for a lot of foods. But the biggest drawback to that is obviously to invest in a freeze dryer is quite the upfront cost. We'll go to freezing. Freezing, super easy. I have an extra deep freezer at our house, so we use that one a lot. But storage is the problem with that one. I think the reason that people end up landing on canning, which you can tell me if that's the one that you're going to recommend for beginners, is because you eliminate a lot of those factors. It's very easy to get into. It's relatively safe when you know what you're doing. And then you can store the cans anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I love canning, but really I would say the easiest is probably using those root cellar techniques, because for certain vegetables, anybody can do that. In fact, I have just on the other side of that room, I should have grabbed them in here. I still have onions, garlic, winter squash, delicata, and Long Island pumpkins. At the time that we're recording this, it's in June. You guys, those were harvested. Yeah. The onions were done in August. The garlic was done in last July, almost a year ago. And those winter squash were harvested in September. And they have literally just been sitting on my shelves in our pantry. It's a heated room, but there's no special humidity. It's just part of our house. So it's not temperature controlled. It's just whatever the temperature our home is.
Yeah.
For almost a year. And I did nothing other than cure them on the initial harvest of those items, and then move them into that room, which doesn't have any exterior windows and is dark. And it stays relatively cool. I would say in the middle of winter when we're really cold, probably about 60 degrees Fahrenheit, when the fire goes out overnight, the house temperature starts to drop. And then in the summer, we don't really have air conditioning, but I do live in the Pacific Northwest. So normally we don't get super hot. We do have some days over 100, very few, a few over 90. We're usually more in the 70s and 80s, and that's about where my house. So 60 degrees Fahrenheit to say 80 degrees Fahrenheit is their general storage. But that's not really cold. That's not like a basement temperature or root cellar temperature. And those specifically, so winter squash, garlic, and onion, those don't need high humidity in order to stay just nice on the shelf. Whereas potatoes, most folks have gotten a bag of potatoes from the store, right? And either it sprouts or they get shriveled up if you try to keep them on the shelf for very long. That's because potatoes and apples, they require higher humidity levels so that they don't shrivel up. And they actually require cooler temperatures than that 60 degrees Fahrenheit mark so that they don't sprout, because it's actually the temperature that encourages their sprouting. Yeah. It's not technically the light. We just want to keep them away from light so that they don't turn green on potatoes, that is.
Yeah. So you're highly dependent here on, like, with the answer being the root cellar techniques. That, of course, is with the caveat of certain things, like obviously not tomatoes. Like, we'll have to talk about that. But like for certain things, that is the easiest way to do it. So what's the procedure for your your squash and your, let's see here, you have your garlic, your onion that has all been in there for almost a year. What is the procedure to get them to that point?
Yeah. So the biggest thing is winter squash across the board is going to do well. And so is garlic. Softneck garlic tends to have a little bit extra longevity as before it will sprout. So I do softneck garlic. And as I said, I've got braids. I've even went 18 months before and they have stored just fine without sprouting. Hardneck garlic, usually about 9 months for me. And then it will start to want to sprout. So knowing your varieties on that. With your onions, this is more specific, is you want to make sure you have got long storage variety onions. Because if you try to do it with a sweet onion, like a Walla Walla or some of those sweeter onions, the sugar content in them, they just tend to rot faster. So if you try this technique with like a Walla Walla, it's not that you did it wrong. They just are not going to store for months. So it's really your... So just kind of knowing those varieties, like Patterson and Copra are good ones. It's usually the yellow storage onions. And so
now I'm trying to remember which ones I planted, because we planted a bunch of onions. And I'm like, wait, did I pick a long storage variety? I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah. Which you can just go back, like wherever you got your seed onions from in your records, and then do a quick Google search or whatever search engine you want. And it'll tell you if it's a storage variety or not. So just knowing that, like start with a good storage variety on onions specifically, but your winter squash, you're good to go. There's no really specific long storage variety of winter squash, just your winter squash. So when you're harvesting your winter squash, you want to make sure, and this is actually true for anything, fruit that you're picking or any vegetable that has a stem, when you pick it, leave part of that stem on. And this is even just if you're going to throw it in the fridge and consume it within a few days. It will give you longer storage capabilities no matter what you're doing with it, even fresh eating. But that stem, once you've removed it, it allows oxygen to get into that fruit or into that squash, et cetera, at a faster rate, and it's going to break down and degrade faster. So even like cherries, leave the stem on. Cherries in the bags, they'll last longer in the fridge, that type of thing. So leave the stem on when you're harvesting your winter squash, or if you're buying winter squash, say like you go to a U-Pick farm or something like that, or even maybe you're a CSA or even the grocery store. Look for in season that winter squash that still has the stem on the end. And it only needs to be like a couple inches or inches fine. It doesn't have to be super long, but you want that stem on. And then you're going to set that winter squash with the stem still on in an area. It doesn't need to be in direct sunlight. Usually indirect sunlight is better, but an area that's warm, preferably 80 degrees or warmer is fine, but good airflow. And you're going to let that, it's called curing. Okay. And so you're just going to let those cure usually about 2 weeks. And if you live in a northern environment like me, by the time my winter squash is actually ripe and ready to harvest and it's fully ripe on the vine, I don't have any 80 degree days left. So I bring mine in.
Yeah, we definitely do. But yeah,
and I set it by our wood stove. You're really just looking for that warmth and good airflow. So I'll just set mine. So I'll have like all this winter squash just like in all over the floor by there and leave it for about 2 weeks. So what you're looking for is that outer rind. If there's any little nicks on it when it's been out in the garden, they'll kind of scar over and harden up, and that outer rind will get hard. And then the stem will go from green. It'll turn a really dark brown. It'll get really dry. That usually takes about 2 weeks. If you're cooler, it could take up to 3 weeks. And after that point, then you're going to want to move it into ideally a room that doesn't have direct light coming in, because as we know, direct light is never, you know, really great for the longevity of food storing, even hope, you know, store-bought food. They'll tell you, try not to store in direct sunlight, et cetera. So you're going to want to move that into a room that doesn't have direct sunlight if possible. And if you have a cooler room in the house, if you're really hot, that would be ideal. And then you'll just move it in there after it's cured. With your onions and your garlic, once those are ready to harvest, this is going to sound funny, but leave the dirt on for the ones that you want to do your long-term storage. Because when you first pull them up, that dirt is moist. And then if you try to wash that dirt off, you're most likely going to use water, and then you're pushing more moisture into that food. So screens work really good. I've used old window screens or even like wire mesh where I can thread the neck of the onion through so that it can hang. And same thing with the garlic. Put them on screens, however, and in an area that's not direct sunlight, because you don't want to get, sun scald on those, and let those dry until the stems, and I leave the stems on because I braid mine. Otherwise, you're going to need to have some type of box or netting that breathes to store them. I find it really easy just to braid them and then hang them in the pantry and be done with it. But you're going to want to go about 1 to 2 weeks. You'll want to check the stem because you don't want any moisture left in that stem. And then the dirt will dry at that point. And then you can, then once it's dry, then you can brush it off. And so you're not bringing a bunch of dirt into the house, but you don't want to wash it beforehand because that's going to push a bunch of moisture in there. And our goal is to get this dried out, especially those outer layers dried out. Once that's fully done, I braid them and then just bring them in and store them. And like the current braid I'm using, like the current onion or the current braided garlic, I'll just keep right in the kitchen and that's fine. But then I keep the rest because my kitchen obviously is hotter from cooking and steam from cooking, et cetera. Yes. And we have windows in our kitchen. So what I'm storing, I put in the back, and then what I'm bringing out front. Yeah. So that's really your basic steps for curing and storing the winter squash, garlic, and onion.
Now, do you have on your YouTube video, I know you share a lot of long storage stuff. So do you have your onion process or your garlic process on there?
Yes.
Okay. I figured. I was looking through your videos. I'm like, I don't see it, but I know it's here somewhere.
It's on. If you go to melissaknorris.com on my website, there's a little search button just at the top, and you can type in like onion curing. I've got winter squash curing, all of those things with videos and step-by-steps. Yeah. So you can actually see what
that makes
it looks
more
like.
Sense to go search your website. That makes more sense. I should know this. It's like I get asked things on my Instagram all the time. Like, do you have this? I'm like, just go to my website and search. You know, and here I'm like, Melissa, where's your onion thing? I just don't see it.
No, it's a natural question, especially when, you know, I know you're like I do. And we have put a lot out there to help people. And so sometimes people just aren't sure, like, oh, where do I find this? Because I'm sure you have a resource. Right. I just don't know where to grab it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people just forget too, because if they follow you on Instagram, they just think of you as somebody who's on Instagram, and they forget that you have a nice organized place somewhere else, which usually it's the hub, the website. So people can go over and search all that stuff up. Okay, so for things like, we can go into tomatoes. For home preservation, what is your favorite method, or what do you end up using the most often in your house?
Okay, with tomatoes, and tomatoes is one of my favorite crops because it's so versatile. Like, I use tomatoes for so many different things. So my favorite universal form way of preserving tomatoes is to just can a plain straight tomato sauce. So I don't do like a pizza sauce and can that. I don't can up extra, you know, like ketchup. Like, I don't do those individual things.
Add it all
I just add it all later. So I just do my straight tomato sauce. And then when I want to make spaghetti, you know, I just let it simmer. And then I put the garlic in and I put the onion in, you know, all those things. And then, like, I don't buy condensed canned soup of any kind, but especially tomato. I couldn't even tell. Well, it was probably 13 years ago that I bought any type of condensed tomato canned soup. And so when I'm making like shepherd's pie or something like that, where you would want a can of condensed tomato soup or a recipe that would maybe call for that, then I just go ahead and use my tomato sauce.
Like a tomato paste?
Yeah. I'll just usually simmer it down a little bit more. So like while I'm browning the meat and assembling for shepherd's pie, for example, I'll just go ahead and throw the tomato sauce in the pan and just put it on simmer and let it evaporate down a little bit more so it is thicker.
Right.
And then go ahead and, you know, brown the meat, straight, you know, all those things. Get the casserole ready to assemble, and then just throw that tomato sauce as it's simmered and it's already condensed down and gotten thicker for me in, and then throw it in the oven and finish baking the shepherd's pie.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So tomato sauce, yeah, is definitely my go-to.
So what is your process for that?
So for tomato sauce, thankfully, you can both water bath or pressure can tomato sauce. So my pressure canner, I can hold 19 pint jars in because it's a double stack large pressure canner, whereas my water bath canner, I can fit in, you know, you can only do one layer because I don't have a pot big enough to double layer. You can actually double layer with water bath cans, but I don't have one that's big enough. So I prefer to pressure or steam can. So steam canning is safe for acidic recipes only. So if it's a water bath canning recipe, then you can do a steam canner. And the reason I like the steam canner is it uses a lot less water. And so I'm not having to heat up my kitchen as much because it takes a lot less energy and time to heat up a few inches of water to create steam than it does this big, huge pot for water bath canning.
Yeah.
But you can definitely water bath can tomato sauce as well. But the key, and this is surprises a lot of people, is with tomatoes and canning, regardless if you are pressure canning or water bath or steam canning, you still need to add acid when you are canning your tomatoes and when you're canning your tomato sauce. The only time that you don't add acid when you are canning tomatoes is if you are pressure canning something like a soup, and then that processing time is already, usually most soup recipes are at least 60 minutes of processing time. Okay. So because it's processing so long, you don't have to add that extra acid. But when you're pressure canning tomato sauce, all of our pressure canned tomato sauce recipe times, and if you're actually following a tested recipe and procedure, you will see it has the added acid. And once you add the acid to that, that means that you don't have to pressure can it nearly as long. I don't actually have it memorized, but I think it's like maybe 20 minutes. So 20 minutes versus 60 minutes is a pretty big time difference.
Yeah.
A lot of people think, oh, if I'm pressure canning my tomato sauce, I don't have to add any extra acid. And that's actually false. But it's a small amount of acid. And when you're doing tomatoes, with the exception of salsa, but for tomato sauce, or where you are doing, you know, your stewed tomatoes, where you're just taking the skins off and putting those in the jars, et cetera, you're adding the amount of acid to each jar. So if it's a pint jar, it's a specific amount. Mm-hmm. If it's a quart jar, it's a specific amount. And that way, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, that each jar has the required acidity in order to stave off any botulism. Right. Whereas if you add it to the whole pot, even if you stir it in good, you know, one amount could have maybe a little bit more than the other, et cetera. So that's the reasoning for that. Mm-hmm. But there's actually quite a bit of options for adding the acid to your tomato sauce. You could do citric acid, which is a very small amount as powder. It's really tiny. You can do bottled, concentrated bottled lemon juice. And this one is another one where people are like, well, think that any type of lemon juice. So like fresh lemons can be used. But when you're canning for acidity reasons, it does need to be bottled from concentrate. And the reason for that is because when we harvest different foods and different varieties, so like a Meyer lemon, you know, versus regular lemon, et cetera, they already have different acidity levels. And based upon how ripe they are, their acidity levels will change. And so to ensure, again, that it's that universal acidity level, it needs to be bottled from concentrate lemon juice. And then the other one that you can use is vinegar. And anytime you're using vinegar in canning pickles or tomatoes, whenever it's your acidity, it does need to be a 5% acidity. And most vinegars that you're going to find on store shelves today are already 5%. The only time I've seen a vinegar not be 5% is if it was like a specialty, like a malt or a specialty flavored vinegar. So if you're wanting to use something besides white vinegar or apple cider vinegar, et cetera, just double check on the label that it says 5%. If it's 4%, don't use it. If it's higher, like a 6%, I've seen that too, you're totally fine because it's higher in acidity and you're not going to create anything unsafe going higher in acidity, but you are if it's too low. So those are the three acid options.
Okay. So yeah, you can't really mess up too much. Yeah. I recently, it was brought up to me that you have to be careful with citric acid because it can be made from GMO ingredients. And I went to check my citric acid and I'm like, it has all the, you know, it's non-GMO. I'm like, okay, I didn't even think to check that. I just thought citric acid, it's natural. So that would be something to be aware of if you are going to store that for your summer preserving to make sure it's not a GMO citric acid.
Yeah. And on the subject of GMOs, I'm glad you brought that up because that is true. You definitely want to check the source where you're getting that from is vinegar, white vinegar specifically.
Oh,
because
I've never thought of that.
I know. I'm sorry. Sometimes I feel bad. I'm like, one more thing to check and be aware of.
That's okay. It's easy to check.
It is. You know, a lot of vinegar, some vinegar is made from corn. Some is made from wheat, but especially if it's made from corn, unless it's certified organic, which is a little bit harder to find.
It's
so
going to be,
thankfully I started using Azure Standard about, oh gosh, like 4 years ago, I think. And they have organic white vinegar that you can get in bulk. Cause I had a hard time finding it at local grocery stores around here. I can only find like maybe a little tiny bottle. And when you're pickling and preserving a lot of food, you're like, oh, that's cute. Cause that little tiny bottle is not going to get you very far. So I was really grateful to find an organic white vinegar source from Azure Standard. But if you're not an Azure Standard customer, et cetera, you can use apple cider vinegar. It's recommended not to use raw apple cider vinegar. I've heard different things on that the acidity levels can change in that. I've not confirmed that through research, but because I've not confirmed it, I'm like, well, probably better, you know, make that a caveat. So apple cider vinegar.
Disclaimer.
Apple cider vinegar is totally fine. So I have done that before where I've bought just organic apple cider vinegar to use for my pickling when I couldn't find an organic white vinegar. And it's completely safe to use. Your brine and your pickles will just be darker because obviously the apple cider vinegar is darker in color. It's not clear like the white. But as far as safety wise, that's totally fine.
Yeah. And it will change the taste some, obviously.
A little bit.
It'll be different than probably how you're used to your pickles. I have my Azure Standard drop. My deadline is in 2 days. So I'm definitely going to go add the vinegar to my order that I already have going. Yeah. So let's dive into pickling since you brought that up. What is like, which vegetables do you usually lean into pickling whenever you're doing your garden preservation?
Yeah. So one of our favorites is actually pickled asparagus because I love a crunchy pickle. Like nobody has time for a soggy pickle, at least in my world. I want it to crunch. And so the great thing is asparagus is naturally a denser vegetable than a cucumber, even though typically we think of cucumber when we think pickles. I think most people's brains kind of go that way. So I love pickled asparagus. It stays crunchy, crispy, and it's just one of our, like flavor profile wise, is one of our absolute favorites. So I can a lot of pickled asparagus, and we have two varieties because my husband likes hot and spicy and I like mild. So if you're ever at my house and you go to pull a jar of pickled asparagus and you see a C on the lid, on the lid. That's for Clay and he likes it spicy. And then Melissa M and Mild and Melissa go together. So I just mark mine with an M.
Right.
But we do a lot of pickled asparagus. And then with cucumber pickles, because I love garlic dill pickles are some of my favorites. I like bread and butter too. And I like to do relishes. I really am a pickle fan. But I will first ferment a lot of crocks. I usually do probably about 3 to 4 gallons of garlic dill fermented cucumber pickles that I'll just then put in the cold storage. But I only have so much space, right, for cold storage for fermented pickles to last a really long time.
Cold,
So then for the rest of the year, once we exhaust that, then I do can up a lot of garlic. And I usually can mine as whole because when it comes to canning cucumbers and keeping them as pickles, keeping them crunchy still, I have found that if I keep them whole, they are crunchier. And then I can slice them into spears or rounds whenever we go to use them. It's also faster. It's much faster for me prep-wise to just throw those in the jars and get them going because I have a lot of other stuff coming in from the garden at that time. But the other key things is picking your cucumbers early in the morning. If you pick them at midday, they're already going to be softer. And once a cucumber goes soft, you're never going to crisp it back up when you're trying to make a pickle. So picking them in the morning while it's still nice and cool and they're still firm, not overripe. And then processing them as soon as possible, not picking them and then waiting like 4 or 5 days before you make them. And I know that can be a little bit hard if you're not growing a large amount of cucumbers. So if you really don't have enough to bother canning, like you're like, I've got enough for one jar, that feels silly. Well, one, ferment those. But if you're trying to get up enough to can, as soon as you harvest those, put them in the crisper drawer of the fridge, and that will keep them for at least a couple of days until probably your next flush comes on. And then the other biggie is making sure that you remove the blossom end of the cucumber because that stores enzymes that can make them turn soft. So make sure that you get that off. And then you processing when you're canning your pickles, I do not use alum. I know a lot of people will say to use alum for crisp pickles. Alum is aluminum. I'm not comfortable adding aluminum into my food. So I don't use alum and my pickles are super crunchy. You don't need to use alum. If you want to add a tannin, because tannins can help pickles stay crunchy, then grape leaves, we grow grapes. So I just grab a grape leaf and put in there. If you're in a part of the country that you have oak trees, an oak leaf also has quite a bit of tannin. What you guys have, And if you're like, I don't have either of those, you can actually use a little black tea. So you can use some black tea and you'll just infuse that into the brine while it's boiling. And then probably most people don't want black tea leaves floating around when they're trying to eat their pickle, like it's going to get in your teeth and texture wise. So you can just strain it out, but that will put the tannins into your brine and therefore you'll have the tannins on board when you're making the pickles and pickling them. So those are kind of my biggest tips, but really that key is to process them as soon as possible and pick them in the cool of the morning before they have a chance to get hot because then they don't have as much water and they're not as crisp. So harvest time does matter.
I like the idea for the black tea for the tannins because I think whenever you're first starting with a lot of this stuff, it sounds very second nature. You're like, let's go grab some grape leaves, you know? But I think people are like, okay, but how many? And do I go out and just like, which oak tree? Like I've never put oak tree leaves in my anything, you know? So I think we're more comfortable with things that are supposed to be food. I mean, once you go down this path, you definitely get a lot more comfortable with all of this stuff. But it's like, okay, tea. I know what that is. I know where to get it. I can steep it. You know, I got this.
Yeah. When it's easy, because I realize not everybody, like where I live, we don't have oak trees that grow here. So we planted grapes because I love grapes, right, is a food source themselves. But the grape leaves are actually really great because you can stuff them like you would cabbage. And they're also great for pickling. But so kind of depends. But again, a lot of people don't have grapes easily accessible depending on your climate and where you live. So the black tea leaves are just a really universal source, super easy.
Does it matter what type of grapes? Like I live in wine country and so we have wineries all around and there's lots of those types of grapes. Do I just go pick those grape leaves?
Yeah, those will work. And so kind of like with anything when you're home for, like look for one, when you're picking your leaves, be it oak or grape, you don't want anything that's blemished, you know, that has a lot of insect damage or shows damage like browning, et cetera, on it. So I usually go for, I really am just looking for one that will fit easily into the bottom of my jar. So I don't go for the huge ones because that's going to be much harder for me to fit into my canning jar. So I kind of go for the ones that are going to be approximately are going to just fit to the circumference of the jar relatively easy. And I just do one per jar. So even if I'm doing a pint jar of pickles or I'm doing a quart, I just grab one and put it in there. I suppose you could do two per quart, but I never have. I've always just stuffed one in there.
Yeah. Well, you can experiment. If stuff turns out a little bit mushy, you know, you'll know next time to add a couple more.
Yeah. And we have both a table eating grape and a wine grape. And I've used both and not noticed any difference between the jars. Yeah.
I've also done bay leaves. They work really well too. So, I mean, you know, there's lots of options. If you just Google tannins.
And they would definitely impart a flavor.
Yes, they do. Which with certain vegetables is very welcome. So, you know, it depends on what you're going for with that. I imagine, does the tea impart some flavor as well?
A little bit, but you know, it's pretty diluted because you're usually making a fairly large, well, I should say, it depends on how much you're making, right? Because then you can, and I'm trying to remember, I've got the book behind me, how much per jar, because there is an amount or like per cups of brine that you put in. And I can't remember them all. And so I have them in here, but I have to find the pickling section.
And tell us again what book this is. This is your canning.
Oh, yes. Sorry. This is Everything Worth Preserving, which this has all the 9 forms of home preservation, including canning. But here I found it. It's on page 46, if you happen to have a copy.
Okay.
And one teaspoon of loose leaf black tea per quart of pickles or one bag of tea.
Okay. That's pretty straightforward.
So approximately, one teaspoon is what you're going to get in a bag of tea. And so that's per quart jar. So if the recipe you're using in the brine, you know, the brine says enough to make 5 quarts, then you're going to know to up that amount per how many quarts you've got going.
Yeah. And you're going to be doing this for fermenting or the vinegar pickles as well. Like I like to add the tannins whenever I'm doing a fermented pickle typically as well. That also helps them to not be as mushy.
Yeah, it's universal for either form or even a refrigerator pickle.
Oh, I never thought to do that. I mean, yeah, that would make a lot of sense. All right, I want to take a break from this great conversation to tell you about today's podcast sponsor, Tubes & Co. Tubes & Co. is an organic skincare company. They have everything from face masks. I just saw on their website that they have a brand new face mask they just launched, to face creams like moisturizers and serums. I especially love their glow serum, to makeup. So I currently have on the Tubes & Co. foundation, the Tubes & Co. eye pencil with their little brush thing that makes it really easy to do eyebrows, the mascara. I'm trying to think of what else I have on here. I own a lot more of their items if I ever want to do the whole contouring palette thing. And occasionally I do that, but most of the time I just stick with the basics for a fresh face that I don't have to worry about all of the junk in makeup. This has been a saga for me over the years because I know that what goes onto our skin actually makes its way in and it affects our health. But a lot of the products that are natural just aren't very good. And like currently right now I'm pregnant and I have the whatever it's called when you get the mask, and I want coverage. I want to use the concealers and the foundations that are at conventional places, but I don't want the chemicals. Tubes & Co. completely solves that problem for me. I've sent all my friends and family their way. I love that it's a small family-owned company. They use all great ingredients. You can check them out, look through them all. They use tallow from grass-fed cows and just all things that I'm very comfortable putting on my skin and in my body. Tubes & Co. is offering Simple Farmhouse Life listeners 10% off your order. If you want to check it out, whether you're in the need for makeup or something to moisturize or cleanse, by using the code FARMHOUSE. So go to tubesandco.com and use the code FARMHOUSE to get 10% off your order and check out some awesome Tubes & Co. products. Okay, so there's lots of questions about I'm sure this happens with you, or you get this question a lot. Lots of preservation concerns. I think mostly people, they hear the beginning part of our discussion about botulism, and then they just are shut down. Like, I'll never understand how to do this without being scared. So the fear of botulism, how do you help people to overcome that? How common is it? How to know that you aren't risking it? What are some signs to look for? What would you say to the, if somebody's just really scared of canning?
Yeah, no, it's great. I would rather take someone who has a concern of botulism and help them get over it, because they're going to be a safer food preserver overall than someone who mm-hmm. has no concern and is just going to do, because I've had people where I've explained, like, that's why this is not recommended, and they don't care. They're going to do whatever they want to do, which we each get to do in our own kitchen. I mean, hallelujah. We have the freedom to do what we want. But I would rather take someone who naturally is a little bit leery, because I know that they are going to be safer overall. So I look at it as a good thing. But on the flip side, you don't want to become paralyzed where you don't preserve any food. So I think the key is understanding mm-hmm. Because we hear the term botulism, and it's a neurotoxin. So it's not like salmonella or E. coli, which in some cases can be deadly, but most of the time you just get sick, right? Where botulism right. is actually a neurotoxin. And so if you get botulism poisoning, you actually have to have an antidote that the hospital would have to call and get shipped to them and administer to you in time, or it is deadly, which I know now sounds really scared. And you're like, oh, goodness.
I'm really panicked.
I know. But the good news is botulism is completely avoidable. I mean, you really can avoid it if you understand how it grows and proliferates, and then why we have the home food preservation safety practices that we do. And then you just follow them. I mean, it really right. is easy to avoid. And it is relatively rare. Like, you do have a few cases. If you, for example, I think it was like 5 years ago or something, there was a potluck, I think in Iowa, it's kind of the middle of the country. Forgive me for not knowing which state it is. Mm-hmm. And someone had home canned potatoes and made potato salad from those home canned potatoes and took it to a church potluck. And those home canned potatoes had not been pressure canned, was my understanding. And people got botulism from it. There was a gentleman in Oregon about 10 years ago.
Oh, I'd feel so bad.
I know. I'm like,
it'd be so bad. And
you already don't want to serve it to your family, but taking it to a public event. I know. I'm like, oh, that poor,
yeah.
I'm assuming maybe woman, test that those poor first. Woman. Yes.
That's like with all of my cheese I've been making lately. I've been like today, we just got into one of the wheels of Asiago, and like 30 minutes before we had dinner, I'm like taking a slice and eating it. You know, I'm like, let's be sure that I don't die before like killing my entire
feed it
family.
To everybody. Yeah. Like, mom will go down. I'll take one for the team.
Like, I'm at least just one of us. Like, I'm like, I'm going to eat one slice of this, and then I'm pretty sure I'll experience some problems between now and lunchtime if there's anything
wrong. If there's any issues.
You'd hate to have the whole family. But yeah, church potluck. Holy moly. I don't think I would ever even like bring my raw cheese, like knowing just like what could go wrong. I just like, whew. Anyway, yeah. Sorry. I like how you explained earlier just how botulism happens and knowing the acidity levels, that knowing the science behind it. So it's not just this mysterious thing where, you know, like it may or may not have botulism. I don't know. Let's just roll the dice. Understanding the science behind it is very comforting.
Yeah, I think so too. I actually was thrilled once I knew, because I, just like everybody, I think almost everybody has heard the term botulism in one form or another. And the most talked about way you get it is from home canned food. And so I'd always eaten home canned food because my mom had canned. That's how I learned to can. I was a little girl and would help her can. But when I started canning for my own family, it really wasn't until a couple of years in that someone said, well, botulism's deadly. And I'm like, what?
Wait, it's deadly?
And I'm like, I didn't know that.
I just feel bad for a few hours.
I'm like, what? Like, wait a minute. Right. Like, that's what I thought. Just be like, right. Like, you just get sick and throw up and maybe have diarrhea for a little bit. And right. So when I learned that, then I was like every jar I would go to open, I was like, oh man, like what, it, you know? And so then I'm like, okay, instead of being scared, like let's get into this. Like, let's educate ourselves and see how we stay safe. So, that's where I started from. So botulism spores, what you need to understand is botulism spores are all around us. You and I come in contact, and anybody who's watching or listening this, you come in contact with botulism all the time. Where botulism gets dangerous is when it's in that non-aerobic, so without oxygen, which is going to be an oil-submerged situation. There's no oxygen beneath the oil level. Or in a canning jar where the oxygen has been sucked out via the vacuum process of water bath or pressure canning. And so those are anaerobic, non-oxygen areas. And if it's not acidic of a 4.6 pH or lower, botulism grows in non-acidic, non-oxygen environments. Okay. And so it's when it multiplies. It's when that botulism toxin begins to multiply and create that toxin in its multiplication, and then we ingest it, that you have issues. Okay. So that's why you hear about it the most with home canned food. So the ways that you avoid that is understanding that acidic foods that are 4.6 or lower on the pH scale can safely be water bath canned. So that's why it's safe to water bath can cherries and strawberry jam, you know, all those different things.
Okay.
If it's a vegetable or a meat or a combination therein, like a soup or a broth, a lot of times people think broth because it's a liquid, you can water bath can it. No, because it's not acidic. So anything that is not acidic has to be pressure canned, because boiling water only reaches 212 degrees Fahrenheit. It really doesn't matter if you boil a pot of water for 5 hours or 20 minutes. Once it hits the boiling point, it doesn't ever get above 212 degrees, the temperature of boiling water. So in order to reach higher temperatures to kill botulism spores, if they're present, which we have to do on those non-acidic foods, the only way to reach those temperatures is to use a pressure canner. You can't reach those temperatures any other way. So knowing that and using a pressure canner for vegetables, for broths, for meats, for soups, etc., that's how we stay safe. Now, there's a little bit that's very simplistic, but there's also understanding the density issue. So pickled eggs are a great food. I like pickled eggs, but pickled eggs, when done at home, need to be stored in cold storage. The reason for that is you have a pickling brine with vinegar, so yes, it is acidic. However, an egg is very, very dense. And so even in a water bath canning inside situation, or if you tried to pressure can it, that vinegar can't reach the inside of the egg in order to acidify it fully. And pickled eggs have tested positive for botulism when they've been done at home and not put in the fridge after initial making for long-term storage. So it's understanding the density, and so following a tested, trusted source. So there's Extension Universities, there's the National Center of Home Food Preservation, you know, there's the Ball Canning Books, there's my book, Everything Worth Preserving. And so really following those places that are following the tested, updated procedures. There was limited canning testing because there's no money to be made in it unless you're Ball, right? I mean, think about it. Like, there's no reason for a lot of companies for testing home canning recipes, because they would rather can the item and have you buy it from them. Yeah.
They'd rather just sell it.
Yeah. There's not a lot of money involved for a lot of our testing. So a lot of our home canning safety was actually from World War II, because they needed people in the U.S. to can at home so that they could ship food to the troops. So if you were canning at home, that left the commercially crops that could be sent over to the troops. So they invested at that time a lot of science for home canning safety, which is where we got a lot of our science information on what is safe canning recipes to ensure that you won't get botulism if you follow them. But then after that ended, they didn't really need the push for people to can at home. So no more funding was given to that. And it was in, I think it was 1995. There was some additional testing and updated testing that was done. I think it was by some different universities. And so if you have a canning book that is pre-2000, because as we know, when studies come out, it takes a little bit for publications to catch up to that new information, just the way the publishing industry works. So I don't recommend using any canning books older than the year 2000, so that it has the updated information in them. And really the biggest changes were no longer recommended to pressure can summer squash by itself. So like zucchini, and that's a density issue. We all know, right? Zucchini gets really mushy when it's cooked. Yeah. So that was a density issue. So you'll still see zucchini in pickled recipes as in relishes, but you won't see it recommended to just pressure can by itself in a jar. That was one of the biggest changes. And then one of the other things to keep in mind too is years back, vinegar was 7%. So if you are using a canning pickle recipe that was maybe your grandma's or great grandma's or great aunt's or whatever, or it's just been passed down in your family, you'll want to look up updated canning recipes so that your brine, like you can use the spices and those flavors, but you want to make sure that
your level.
Yeah, you're going to need higher levels of vinegar because now vinegar is standardized at 5%, not 7%. So those are probably kind of the two biggest things to look out for in using outdated books on processing times and items when it comes to canning. But if you just follow those basic principles, then you're going to be fine because it's relatively rare. I mean, you think about how many people do can in the United States, and there's a lot, actually. There's a lot of people that can.
Oh, yeah.
It's very rare recorded anyhow of botulism. Like I said, we can kind of trace it back to two events. There was the church potluck, and then there was a gentleman in Oregon, I think this was like 10 years ago now, who pressure canned venison, which you can do. It's delicious, but he didn't let it go the whole time. And that's another key thing when you're pressure canning. If it says to do it at 10 pounds of pressure for 20 minutes, you need to do it the whole 20 minutes. Don't just cut it in half to like 10.
Right.
So he didn't let it process as long as it was supposed to. And so then the jar's all sealed, which is another misnomer. Just because a canning jar seals does not mean that the contents are safe. It just means a vacuum happened from it getting hot and then cooling, and that it created a vacuum and sucked that lid down. So don't assume that a seal makes something safe. It's how it was processed and the ingredients therein. So he put these jars on the shelf after he canned them and cut his time. And then a couple weeks later, one of the jars lost its lid. And bless his heart, he ate it. 3 days later, another jar lost its seal, I should say. Like the seal came undone. Like it was sealed and then the seal came undone. And so if you have a canning jar, this does not have any food in it, obviously. It had dehydrated cherries, which was my snack here in my office. So if you have a canning jar sitting on the shelf and it was all the way sealed and then it loses its seal, that means that there's something wrong on the inside. There's some type of bacteria. There's something that caused it to lose its seal. You never ever, ever consume a jar of home canned field that lost its seal.
Okay.
Ever.
Yeah.
That was his first mistake.
That was the second mistake.
3 days
he
later,
already messed up.
That was the second mistake. Yeah. 3 days later, another jar lost its seal and he ate it. And that was the jar he got botulism poisoning from. So
did he make it?
He did make it. He was in the hospital for quite a while, but he did make it. He did get the neurotoxin in time that he made it. I don't know if he had any permanent nerve damage because it is a neurotoxin. I don't know if I don't know, but he did make it. So with botulism though, because this is the other thing people always say, like, okay, well, how do I know if I have it in the food? Like it's odorless, it's tasteless, and it's sightless. So you don't know if a jar has it. And that's why people get scary. But the good news is if you follow tested recipes and procedures, then you can be assured that it is safe, that it's fine as long as you just follow those. So, I am a very creative cook in the kitchen. You probably are too, Lisa. Like we recipe develop, both Lisa and I do.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
recipes are a guideline that's fine with your baking and cooking. It's not okay when you're canning. That's where you really, it's key that you follow every single step in a canning recipe because it's there for a specific reason.
Yeah. And like you said, you're following the instructions on the acidity. You're following the instructions on how long to process it. We don't have these same concerns with a store-bought. Like we just assume that they follow the procedures properly. So it shouldn't be any more scary when we are following something that's trusted, tried and true in our own kitchens to then consume the food. Like I don't think anybody does, right? Like you don't have the fear that maybe the factory did something wrong whenever they canned it. Like you just take for granted that's going to work. So you're basically doing the exact same thing. You're just taking it into your own hands. And hopefully the amount of situations that you brought up definitely should also make you less nervous. Like, okay, this isn't like just waiting to happen if I just make one tiny mistake, you know?
Yeah. And truthfully, like when you look at store-bought food, like there's a lot of recalls, but you're right. Nobody is at the store like, oh my goodness, do I or do I not open this? Do I throw it out? You know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing with home canned food specifically, and like I said, there's a lot of different ways to preserve food. Canning is just one of them. But if you are super nervous, you're like, I did everything right. I'm sure I did everything. Like I followed all the stuff, but I'm still nervous. And this is usually for pressure canned food, not water bath, because people have higher concerns with the pressure canning versus water bath because of acidity and safety. If you boil the contents for 10 minutes, then that, now it's not a safeguard against just canning things you shouldn't or not following the total time, etc. But if you are really nervous about it, boil the food for 10 minutes before consuming. And if there was any suspected thing, that is tested from the National Center of Home Food Preservation and their recommendation. Like, as I said, it doesn't mean that you can can something the wrong way. I still wouldn't consume it even if you boiled it for 10 minutes. But if you did everything right and you're still nervous, boil it for 10 minutes. It will give you peace of mind, and then go ahead and eat it.
Yeah. Yep. I personally feel more confident understanding the science behind it and knowing that, I mean, we've eaten lots of home canned foods, and I don't even know that I've done everything necessarily by the letter, but I like the idea of having a book like yours, following the instructions and then putting up the harvest. We didn't even get into fermenting, and we're already totally over time.
<We are. laughs>
But yeah, but that's something for another day. That's another great thing too, if, you know, not for like years and years storage, but for up to 9 months. There's no botulism risks with it. Not that, I mean, I'm totally confident canning too. That doesn't, you know, but for people who are nervous about that, there's so much more to discuss on this topic. Tell us about your book, your YouTube channel, your website, where to find you to dig deeper into a lot of this information.
Yeah, thank you. Well, definitely my website, as we said earlier, that's really the hub. And I've got a ton of recipes and tutorials, both video on operating a pressure canner, pressure canning recipes, water bath recipes, fermenting, all the things, the root cellaring, curing, dehydrating. But like, really, if you're wanting a resource to dive into all the ways with home food preservation, with the understanding of how does this preserve the food and how do I understand the science behind it so that I feel confident, and all of my recipes, then really my book, Everything Worth Preserving, which is my newest book. The nice thing about this one is it covers all the different ways of home food preservation. And the front half of the book has all of the how-to. So if you've never canned before, there's like step-by-step pictures that will walk you through it, even like fermenting. So here, like, walks you through every single step.
Yeah.
But the part that I was excited about was really the part that I wanted, because as I started doing all of these different things of home food preservation, we started putting up more and more and more of our own food. I got tired of trying to hunt and peck between like 5 different books or like all these different sheets that I had downloaded or charts that I had like handwritten out myself. Because when you're in the busyness of preserving mode, I just need everything in one place for the love. Mm-hmm. So the last half of the book, we did in alphabetical order. And so you go to the, and you just look up, like, I want to know what to do with pears.
Okay.
And so under the pear section, it tells you, there's a chart that says all the ways, I know it's really tiny, you can't see it on the camera, but it tells you all the ways, yes, you can safely water bath canned pears, you can steam canned pears, you can dehydrate pears, you can freeze them, you can freeze dry them, you can ferment them, and you actually can even root cellar pears for a period of time, similar to apples. And then it's got all of the instructions on how to do pears, and then knowing Asian pears are not as acidic as regular pears. So Asian pears need extra acid added if you're canning them, but it's all right here. So if I've got a bunch of pears coming in, all I got to do is go to the P section under pear, and then all of the recipes and the way to preserve pears, it's all right there for me. And I had never found a book myself until I wrote this one that had all of that with all of your fruits and vegetables, including meats, like A through Z. So it ended up being over 400 pages because there's really no other way to fit all of that in there. The resource that I needed when I was busy. Yeah. So if you're really looking into getting into home food preservation, I have to say this is going to be your best in-depth resource of covering all the things and all the foods.
Yeah, and all the different ways. I like that, because you might take one thing that you have a lot of and then just do like different ways even for that one thing.
Yeah, because I mean, I love my whole garlic dill pickles, but I also like a lot of other ways for cucumbers. You know, there's a lot of different relishes and different things. You're like, you can only eat so much of one kind. And also, for one thing, was knowing what are the ways, like, I love broccoli, but you don't can broccoli. Like, broccoli is not... Most of the brassicas are not recommended for canning. So I'm like, okay, well, what are the ways, aside from freezing, that I can do stuff with all my extra broccoli that we have? Because it's only going to last so long in the fridge or out in the garden, that type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great resource. Well, we will leave links to all of that down in the description box or the show notes, depending on if you're watching on YouTube or listening on one of the podcast apps. Thank you so much, Melissa, for coming on and sharing your knowledge. I feel like we just scratched the surface, but it definitely got my wheels turning on some things that I didn't really know or weren't explained that clearly to me. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. If you can't tell, it's one of my favorite topics. So yeah. I always enjoy getting to share with other people.
Yes, no, I can definitely tell your passion for it. Thanks again.
As always, thank you so much for listening, and I will see you in the next episode of the Simple Farmhouse Life podcast.